Tonight, no sign of joy, maybe in others, not me. The music has no taste tonight. The beloved is away. So we have no share of joy this evening, for the loved one is missing from the assembly. The lute, the candle, the witness are present, but the source, the connection, is not here tonight. This is a poem by one Alauddin Kermani, a great Sufi, and he's describing an experience of what's known as Sama, which is a central practice for many Persian and Indian Sufis, maybe even Arab Sufis too. It's this practice of Sama literally means audition, hearing. And the Sufi musicians will sing settings of Hafez or Rumi or other poets, Amir Khusrau in India. And the Sufis, the practitioners, they listen. They listen attentively to the beautiful poetry, to the beautiful music. And through that they're transported into ecstasy, into wajd, as it's called. But Kermani's poem is describing how this is not happening on this particular night. Everything is there. The musicians are there. The candle is burning. His friends in the assembly, his brothers are there in the assembly. The musicians presumably are singing well. There's even the presence of the witness, the beautiful person. But the deeper beauty is not there. The beloved is away. So the music has no taste tonight. The music has no taste tonight. And it can be like that with our own practices, I think, with our meditation, our pujas, our Dharma study, our work for the Dharma, indeed our whole life, even in our chapter meetings or order meetings, our order conventions even. Our whole life generally can be blighted at times, maybe even for long periods, with a lack of delight, with the lack of the presence of beauty. Sometimes we can have periods of dryness, it seems, that go on day after day, week after week, year after year. And this can lead to, of course, serious crisis. And it's obviously an issue for the Buddhist tradition. There's the classic story of this, of course, is the well-known story of Nanda. A bit understandable for Nanda, because the Buddha turned up at his wedding feast and took him away into the forest and ordained him. Whilst Nanda was, you know, following the Buddha, looking behind at his new bride, leaning out of the window, the Sakyan girl, the fairest in her land, with her hair half combed, saying, "May you soon be back, young master. May you soon be back, young master." So I think it's understandable that in meditation he'd just be seeing that beautiful image of his beloved. Saying all the time, "May you soon be back, young master." We won't go into the ethics of the Buddha taking him off. We did ask Banti about that once, and he said, "Well, the Buddha knew what he really wanted." Nanda said, "I have no zest. I have no zest for this life because I'm always dwelling on my wife." And the word, it was reported to the Buddha that this was happening. So the Buddha talked to him, and first of all he ascertained, is it true? You have no zest. You want to give up. You want to go back, to that life. And he says, yes, it's true. So somehow or other, we don't really know how this happens, the Buddha takes him to the heaven of the 33, to the Nanda Hall, the hall of great joy, where all these dove-footed, pink-footed devis are gathering in attendance around Sakka. And they are so utterly, overwhelmingly beautiful. They are actually more beautiful than the Sakyan girl, the fairest in the land. And, you know, obviously the Buddha is, you know, says, well, you can have this. This can be the beauty for you. And you know the story that the word then goes round. We don't quite know how the word goes round, that he's just meditating for nymphs, for devis. And Nanda thinks, I'll show them, and gains arhatship. It's a lovely story. But Abhaya, on our seminar up at My Squint, pointed out a sutta, which I haven't been able to track down, where the Buddha talks about three hard things. It's hard to renounce. It's hard to find delight having renounced in the life, in the Dharma life. It's hard, having found delight, to give up the lesser delight for the higher, the greater delight of Nirvana. So it can be like that for us, even though we might not have renounced like Nanda. Sometimes we just go through these long periods of terrible, soul-destroying dryness. The music has no taste, not just tonight, but every night. The music has no taste. What to do? Nanda's story, I think, is very instructive. The Buddha doesn't give him a severe reprimand about how ugly the Sakyan girl is. I mean, there is a little thing that comes later where Nanda says, well, even if she was a mutilated she-monkey, she's... And Bhante, actually, when he does the seminar on the Three Jewels, he sort of almost refutes that part of the sutta and says, no, it's not like that. It's more like that it's more like you have different mirrors that reflect beauty more fully and completely. He doesn't go in for this, you know, pummeling, if you like, of the beauty on the human level, which I find a relief, actually, a relief. But the story is so instructive because the Buddha shows him a beauty that is near to him, a beauty that is near to him. And there's a message for us, I think, when we're dry and when we're toiling. We need to find beauty, we need to find delight in what is near to us, in what is near to us. I did a solitary retreat at the beginning of the year, and solitary retreats and me have a difficult relationship with solitary retreats. Immediately I go on a solitary retreat, I feel a terrible loneliness. Pain, really. A real intensity of experience. It doesn't matter how near or far I am from people. I just find that I'm immediately up against me. And the other thing I find about solitary retreats is I come, I guess, into contact with the sheer chaos of my life. How spread out I seem to be between the sublime and the ridiculous, the beautiful and the utterly banal. And I find that so, upsetting. Beauty and meaning seem so fleeting, and they just sort of dissolve in a kind of maelstrom of, yes, well, the only word is banality. Brief moments of something wide open, searingly beautiful, only to be immediately followed by days of toil and longing. Early on in that retreat, I had a dream in which Bhante said very, very clearly, he said, it really was just like Bhante said, trouble is, most order members don't realise how profound integration is. And I left my retreat and I came home to my loving community, which was such a wonderful thing. I feel so blessed that I live with such kind friends. They knew that I'd had a rough time, and they'd cleaned my room. There were beautiful flowers in my room arranged by Junipolita. They wanted to hear all about what had happened, so they brought lunch in my room and was sitting, talking, laughing. You need friends. You really need friends if you're going to live the Dharma life well. And of course, you need to not just put yourself in conditions for that, you need to create conditions if you're going to enjoy that kind of friendship. You need to be a friend. You need to be a friend with friends and create an environment of friendship for one another. So I was very fortunate in that way. I am very fortunate in that way. And I had some time after my solitary retreat just to arrive back and in a way sort of continue with the issues with the retreat. And I was struggling with that. So I'd done quite a bit of meditation on this retreat. And I was talking to another dear friend, Arloka, about what was happening. And he said, look, why don't you come at all this from another angle? You know, I gave you that big canvas a while back. Why don't you paint? Why don't you paint round it? Why don't you come from the side, so to speak? Serve the gods of useless endeavours, as he calls it. So that's what I did. I just played with paint. I used an indirect means. I think we really do need to look at this direct and indirect means. I think people think direct means the real thing. Indirect means second best. It's not like that at all. That's not what it means. Indirect, most of the time we're operating indirectly. We're not. Meditation is when we work directly on consciousness. You know, we're drawn from the senses and so on and so forth. Most of the time we're operating through other media to work on our consciousness. That's called life. We are dharmacharis and dharmacharinis. We're livers of the Dharma. All our life needs to be involved with this endeavour. So I played with paints on this big canvas, just pouring on the paint, sweeping, great big sweeping brush marks. There was so much pleasure in this, so much absorption in this activity. I wasn't trying to make a painting to show to people. I wasn't trying to do the religion of art. I was playing. Just playing. Just for the sheer pleasure of paint and splashes and marks on the canvas. It's lovely, by the way, seeing Dharmamati drawing here on this retreat. Just to say, to see somebody doing that. Just in that condition. No, he is actually making pictures. And if we're to talk about finding delight, finding beauty, I think we need to talk about playing. I think we need to talk a lot more about playing. But I think play is terribly underrated. I gather that for some philosophers, I think, is it Etienne Gilson? He did a whole book. I think he was a great French scholar of medieval thought and Renaissance thought. I think he wrote a book on Homo Ludens, is it? A man at play. And I think some philosophers believe that this is it's fundamental to human life, but man at play. I haven't looked into this enough, but I really would like to do more of that. Yesterday I was so happy. In fact, this whole retreat, I feel, although slightly drunk, I feel very happy. And particularly what made me happy yesterday was just setting up that seat, seeing Sangadeva come into the room. And he looked absolutely beautiful, you know, the sweat drenched and carrying this lovely green grass. And seeing the beautiful women's team make the seat and pour flowers on the seat. And Yashodeva came in and we were just looking at this wonderful scene unfolding before us. It's so incredibly beautiful. And what we were witnessing was play. But play offered up to the Buddha. play offered up to what is highest and deepest. I felt even a kind of childlike excitement yesterday before the puja that I haven't felt for a long time on a festival day, because we'd played. And I was so, it was so pleasing to see people bringing their posies of flowers and dressing up and so on. There was real lalata, I think, yesterday. And lalata is an interesting word. It means play, but it also means sport. It's also the word for the arts in Indian tradition. The arts are known as lalata. I remember years ago on the first Guhyaloka course I went on in 1990, which Subhuti led, and on that course Subhuti really developed the rituals of the ordination course. And I remember Subhuti saying to us in an order meeting that, or in the course, he said we were doing, I don't remember what ritual it was, you know, and there's bits of paper and stones up a mountain and, you know, all that sort of thing and mantras. And Subhuti said he had a kind of flashback to when he was a lad in his Kent garden with his sword and, you know, I think tucked into his snake belt and playing pirates or something like that. But here was play engaged with something deeply meaningful. Perhaps that's what ritual really is, and perhaps it would be better if we could approach ritual not in a sort of heavy ritual kind of way, but more as play, making it into our play, making our own play. I think if we want beauty, if we want to love, we really do need to play and to create in this very innocent and simple way. I think it's so easy in relation to, in the world today, that to, I do it too easily, you know, with a click of a button, you can just distract yourself and just go passive. You associate play with something so passive, and that just increases the impoverishment. When we play, we create. I was thinking that something that I heard Sir Roy Strong said years ago. Roy Strong, the great aesthetician, I think, great art historian, has also developed a wonderful garland, garden, a great scholar, I think, of art history. I think he was the curator of the V&A at one time as well. He was asked, Sir Roy was asked once, what is beauty, in an interview? And he said, what is beauty? He said, well, beauty is you're having some friends round for dinner. You put a lovely cloth on the table. You go out into the garden. You pick some flowers. You put them in a vase and you put them on the table. And you lay the table for your friends. That's beauty. What a wonderful thing to say. That's beauty. And notice, it's not just for you. It's for your friends. There's a courtesy that goes with beauty. I think courtesy, you know, and I can talk because I know I can be terribly kind of crude, but I think courtesy is a really, really wonderful art, actually. And it's one of the things I really miss about India is the courtesies that you receive. From the sometimes the most poorest, uneducated people, they're the most artistic people. The art is in their courtesy. The art is in their being, in the way they invite you into their home, the way they give you tea, that they make you feel comfortable. So many times I've experienced that, and you feel enriched. You feel beauty. There's no question about that. I remember once, you know, sometimes you experience this before you give a Dharma talk in India. You go before the Dharma talk, there has to be the offering of garlands and all the courtesies have to be gone through, the proper courtesies and the proper introductions and so on. And I remember once I was ill. I really didn't want to go and give a talk that Bodhi Sen had arranged in Bombay. And I said, I can't go, I have a fever. I really can't go. I was really quite ill, I was quite worried. And Bodhi Sen's face just dropped, he just looked so upset. So I said, okay, I'll come, but we're getting a taxi. I'm not going on the rush hour bus down to Bombay Central. There's no way I'm doing that. Okay, we'll get a taxi. And just come, just be there. do the refuges and precepts, and then go back in the taxi, and that's it. I said, yes, we'll do that. Because the reason why, because it was a new area, it was a different community. It was the Bungi community, the Gujaratis in Bombay Central, Gujarati Bungis. They hadn't really had a lot of contact with Buddhism. And we went to this place, it was the sweepers area, the municipal sweepers, who do really, really dirty work. And the place was, they'd made it so beautiful with the fairy lights at night time, and these people were so pleased we'd come. And I said, I'll say a few words. And of course, I went on and on and on, because they'd drawn it out of me, their courtesies and the beauty of this whole scene. And I have to say that it's really good giving a Dharma talk when you have a fever. You really get ecstatic. You really start going places. And I did pay for it the next day, but it was worth it. So I'd really like us to think about this. If you're feeling dry, well, do something really simple. You know, pick some flowers, put them in a vase, give them to a friend, something like that. I'm sure that would enrich your life, your Dharma life. It's not all about insight, you know. One of the ways a Bodhisattva gathers a community, it's very interesting that this is listed. Yes, there's all the wonderful teaching and exemplification and great skill in oratory and so on. Wonderfully advice about how to meditate. He provides festivity. Festivity, which is defined as a day or many days, long periods in which the community can enjoy itself skillfully. Can enjoy itself skillfully. Can come together and just take great delight and pleasure in the Dharma. And I can remember, you know, with festival days, I've even sort of felt it myself, but I remember somebody once saying, well, I don't do festivals, they interrupt my routine. Yeah, actually that is the point. That is actually what it's supposed to do, because actually you've become really boring. You are boring. We are boring. You are dry and dull and terribly Protestant. Festivals. Come on, let's celebrate. That's the whole point. They're days to open up, to celebrate the Buddha. I think actually this is the real meaning of order weekends and order conventions. They're really festivals to enjoy one another and to celebrate our life. I remember one order convention. It was when Subhuti was the order convener. He got up and said, look, we've got a program, we're going to do this and we're going to do that, but actually we don't really need it. What a convention is just being together. And just being together, it doesn't really matter what we do together. And it was such a relief when he said it, because people come with their dance cards to have lots of individual meetings and meetings to sort this, that. No! Stop! Pleasure, enjoyment, celebration. Celebrating our life together. Such a relief when you said that. So this area is so very important for the enrichment of our life. I think Heidegger has some very interesting things to say about holidays. He goes back to the whole idea of the holy day. He says a festival day, a holy day, a holiday is a time when you refresh. Probably puts it much more complicated than this. You refreshed your direct experience of being, of the wonder of being. That's what you're really supposed to be doing on a holiday. Because most holidays are just going, you know, he doesn't use this language definitely, but I interpret it, you just blob out after your wage slavery. So this area is so very important. I'm going to put in another thing, birthdays. I think birthdays really do need to be celebrated. We make quite a thing of this at Padmaloka. We celebrate everybody's birthday. It's usually in the mornings of our morning meeting, and there's presents, and we've got this thing. Everybody has to look at the present that the person receives, and so on and so forth. But it's part of this, I would say, this playfulness and this taking delight in your friends. And games. I think games are really important for the health of a community. even sports, you know, like table tennis and volleyball. And I mean, some of the boys at Padmaloka, they really like board games, these really complicated board games. Matthew, our French lad, loves these really complicated board games. And I've gone and joined in because I just want to be with the atmosphere. And I always lose. I don't know what they're doing, really. And I keep to, but I just want to be with them because they're playing. Playfulness really means that there's an abundance, I think. And I think this does need to pervade our lives. I think there can be a kind of cult, almost, of that you're really deep if you're miserable. Go down into the ashes and, you know, that means you're deep. Actually, it's another version of superficiality. That doesn't mean that you're really seeing dukkha. It means that actually you're just miserable. I'm not saying we need to... You know, we do need to face our dukkha, but I'm talking about something else, almost a professional misery. I remember a friend of mine, somebody I would ordain, you know, every time I met him, you know, going round in circles in this miserable way and all this sort of rubbish psychology about what he's going through. And at one time I said, look, have you tried Buddhism? Have you tried the Dharma? Seemed to think it was Buddhism. Mustn't forget that there is this negative state called Domanasa, which is really the misery that comes from indulgence in unskillful states. That's not a realization of dukkha. And this Somanasa, which is the joy which comes from the generation of skillful states. So play, pleasure, enjoyment in these simple ways and creating the environment in which we can play with one another. Bant is so playful. I remember when I had my Anagarika ceremony and I was, you know, very solemn, you know, because I was taking the Brahmacharya vow. I knew what I was thinking at the time. But anyway, we didn't go there. But I asked to see him so that I could learn how to wear the robes. So I went up to his study. And I went and I said, well, could you show me how to wear the robes? Because I don't want them to fall off when I go to India. That was one of the reasons. But I said, oh, they'll fall off. You know, it's like, you know, with glee. You know, they'll fall off and, you know, until you get used to it. And then he was showing me how to tie the belt. So I'd made this belt and Bant is tying it up round his waist. And it's not quite tying up for Banty. And he said, you're going to need to get a longer belt. And I'm thinking, actually, it's okay for me, this belt. And he turned to me with this really wicked grin and said, ah, maybe you won't have the trouble that I'm having. But with this grin, it was gleeful grin. So play, it's such a big part of Bante, actually, in his communication of the Dharma. And I mentioned the other day in the question and answer session, the Bodhisattva Leela. We need it. We need some of that. We need to look to that. There's a form of Padmasambhava that I'm particularly fond of. Fortunately, I can't find anything really written about it. What a relief. And he's deep pink. And yes, he's wearing his hat and robes, but the robes are really lush. And he's a boy. He's a boy with this sort of slight frown, slight grin, deep pink. And he's got a kind of red lotus garland and red lotuses in his hair. And his feet, it's not the usual Raja Leela. It's like, you know, when you see children, you know, and they're sort of sitting with, you know, upright and their legs are sort of slightly all over the place. It's rather like that. He has black locks in this form that would ensnare the triple world, and black eyes whose glance would kill, and rosy lips that bring to life. I love that form. Now, that's all very well. But with all that, still there are those times, those long times, of that feeling of lack, of the absence of the beautiful. And that longing, that even that anguished longing that goes with that. I'm coming to the conclusion, it was getting clearer through talking to Subhuti yesterday, that I actually need to go much more deeply into that anguished longing, almost embrace it more fully without doing the professional cult of misery. I've always been attracted to this Abhilasha Shraddha, the Shraddha which is an intense longing. The usual explanation is that you long to leave dukkha and craving. You long to attain nirvana. You long to follow the path. I'd like to look at it in another way, or related way, in relation to beauty. Not systematically. I'm finding it very hard to be in any way systematic. If beauty, I quoted William Blake the other day, beauty is abundance. If beauty is abundance, our condition is one of poverty. Existential poverty, existential indigence. It doesn't matter how much wealth anybody has, or even, listening to Subhuti earlier, how much beauty there is present. Actually, our real condition is utmost poverty. I mentioned the other day the Sufi who had the visionary experience of everything being swallowed up in a dazzling darkness into black light, and that this was associated with the realization that he had nothing, there was nothing that made him be. And I said it reminded me of some of the things that Bhante had said about the realization of Aishvarya. Our complete lack of lordship and mastery. Apparently in Indian thought, this is something Bhante mentions in the survey, selfhood is associated with lordship, mastery. You know, what you have mastery over, that is yourself. Well, on analysis, and we see this very clearly in the element practice, we have no real power at all. We have nothing with which to be. One of the names of the Arahant, the enlightened man, is the man of naught, the man of nothing. And in his essay on the flowering bowl, Bhante talks about the symbolism of the empty begging bowl that the Buddha holds. The empty begging bowl, he says, is not only the symbol of conventional mendicancy, it is also the symbol of absolute spiritual poverty, of complete conceptual nakedness, of utter self-deprivation, in a word, of shunyata, the voidness itself. And by the way, dervish means a pauper. It means literally a man of nothing. A real dervish is someone who's realized their absolute spiritual poverty. I have a hunch that the way forward for me is to embrace this condition much more fully, this poverty, this lack, this absence of the wealth and the richness of beauty, and to embrace the anguished longing that goes with it, not to avoid it. I think I'm even trying, even in my own way, to kind of sing out of it, both literally and metaphorically. One of the things I've been noticing on solitaries in recent years, I spend a lot of time singing. Not really songs with words. They're a sort of stream of all the Indian classical and Qawwali music that I've heard over the years. It's just my own kind of version, inarticulate version of this. I'll go for walks and I'll just be singing these songs of longing, which seem to get more and more intense as it goes on. And on retreat, I'm saying, oh, for goodness sake, stop it. Come on, you know, think about the Dharma. Reflect on the Dharma, come on. And I just can't do it. I just can't stop singing. And I always have in mind that little fragment from that poem that Bhante wrote in Finland, Sequence from a Strange Land. These very concentrated, almost haiku-like poems. And there's one little set of verses that goes something like, I do not care if I don't write any more poems. It's enough to say how the heart bleeds and bleeds. And I should just say that these longing songs are not for a person. They're not for anyone. If they're for anything, they are for my Lord in the most beautiful of forms. And I have to admit, I get really uncomfortable when Subhuti talks about boredom. About, you know, boredom opening up the experience of beauty. I can't do boredom. It's too intense. This is a real failing. But I can, in private, just sing. Sing from this state of lack, of poverty, of longing. It's a newish thing, this, and and I really wish I could sing. And it explains why, perhaps, I'm so drawn to traditions that make longing into a path. The Sufis, of course. Indian Sufis, some of them, picked up on Indian traditions, what we would call Hindu traditions, that make longing a path. There's this tradition known as viraha, this word viraha. It's a rasa, a taste, an aesthetic, the aesthetic of viraha, associated with the rainy season, the time of love. Viraha is anguished love in separation. Anguished love in separation. It's associated particularly with a woman. And it's particularly taken up in Vaishnavism, especially Bengal Vaishnavism, with the image of Krishna and the gopis. Krishna is incredibly beautiful, that dark blue god. And the gopis come to him, who are all married, they're all married to, they've all got husbands, and they come illicitly to Krishna. And Krishna shows his beautiful face to them in the dance. And as soon as the gopi thinks, he's mine, he spurns her. So she's left with this viraha, this aching sense of separation in love. And the devotee, whether he's male or female, has to identify with the gopi. You get other imagery in Indian traditions to do with this, to really, you know, intensify this sense of longing. One of my favourite songs in Marathi begins like this. Majje mahera pandari, majje mahera pandari. It's a song by Eknath, and it's, how can I translate it? A mahera is, it's the voice of a woman who is with her, who's married, and she's with her in-laws. She's had to leave her family home, and she's with her husband's family. And she's singing about her mother's home, her ancestral home. There's a word for that in Marathi, mahera. She's singing of her mahera. But her mahera is Pandari. That is the abode of the god Vithoba, which is a bhakti god in Maharashtra. She's singing this longing song. It's so tender that you know, the feeling for the place of the god, the place of devotion. And whether you're the song was written by Eknath, who was a man, he's adopting that rasa, that persona, if you like. And I was in a house in Nagpur with a Buddhist, and there was an old man singing to me his songs about Dr. Ambedkar and the Buddha. And I noticed he was using the word mahera in one of his songs, and he was describing the Diksha Bhumi, the place of the great conversion, as his mahera. It was so lovely to hear. But there is in Buddhism too anguished longing. We had it last night from the Sarvana Bhasotama Puja, constantly kneeling on the ground. I am consumed with longing to see the teacher, weeping pitifully for the sake of the leader. I am consumed with the fire of longing. Give me the cool water of your appearance, O conqueror. Probably this was originally sung. I like to imagine that. And notice in that intense longing for the Buddha in that verse from that sutra, how it then moves into a reflection on Shunyata, and there's a reference to the Tathagata Dhatu, the realm of the Tathagata, perhaps the vast consciousness of the Tathagata. It only opens up through this intense longing. In Tibetan tradition, you have this wonderful genre of song and poetry, the cry of longing to the guru from afar. You're a long way from your teacher, whether he might be present in your place or you might be in retreat. And you just have this longing to be with him, for him to come. And the mood is one of sadness and exile. You're far away from the guru and the community and overwhelmed by samsara. And you cry out of your longing and out of your love for your spiritual friend. I saw there's a Tibetan Lama who's been a refugee Lama who's been being cared for a bit in Sheffield. And I asked him to sing Jamgon Kongtrul's famous cry of longing to the guru from afar. And he was singing it, and tears were just rolling down his cheeks. He was really in this mood, and he was telling me later he was thinking of his teacher, who I think has died now. But it's also there in the Pali tradition, I think, this intense longing. It's there. There's the story of Vakali, you know, the story of Vakali. Well, I've got a real feeling for Vakali. He's found in he's found in a sutta in the Sangyutta Nikaya, which I'll mention a bit later. But there's quite a lot of commentarial material on him, and there's a wonderful gata. One of his songs is found in the Tathagata. The Buddha says he is foremost among those liberated through faith. And the story goes like this. Vakali was a young man in Shravasti. No particular interest in Buddhism, the Dharma, living the Dharma life. He saw the Buddha one day and he fell in love with the Buddha. He was just so struck by the beauty of the Buddha. And he just wanted to be with the Buddha all the time. So he thought, well, the only way I can do that is by getting ordained. Didn't particularly want to. So he went forth, he took the yellow robe, and he spent all his time in Shravasti, sitting close to the Buddha, just kind of looking at the Buddha, just completely looking at him, just wondering at him all the time, just pretty much for the whole of a rainy season retreat. He was just gazing on the Buddha, and the Buddha didn't really respond to him. Indeed, at the end of the rainy season retreat, the Buddha just said to Vakali, go, go, you're not to stay with me, go. Didn't tell him where to go, just said, go. And Vakali couldn't say, well, couldn't we have a bit of a talk about it? Couldn't we, couldn't report in to anybody about it? Could we have some mediation? You know, my teacher's rejected me. No, go, go. And he went into retreat. He went into the forest. And he was rapt. He was just so filled with anguish at being separated from the Buddha. He was desperately alone in the forest and his beloved teacher's not there. And so much so, he starts to have visions of the Buddha. But when the visions appear, the Buddhas say, stop it. Get on with your meditation. Don't look at me. And at some point, you know, he goes on, he keeps practicing. At some point, the Buddha comes to him in retreat. And Vakali is not having an easy time. He's got a lot of pain, stomach pain. There isn't very much alms food. He's missing his teacher. And the Buddha says to him, stricken by sharp stomach pains, you, bhikkhu, dwelling in the forest, where it's harsh and hard to get food, what will you do? And Vakali sings, flooding the body with abundant rapture and bliss. flooding the body with abundant rapture and bliss. Enduring what is harsh, I shall dwell in the forest. developing the bases of mindfulness, the faculties, the powers, and the factors of enlightenment, I shall dwell in the forest, recollecting men who are resolute, who put forth energy, constantly firm in their effort, who are harmonious and united. I shall dwell in the forest, recollecting the perfect Buddha, the foremost, the self-tamed, the perfectly composed and concentrated, with untiring effort, both day and night. I shall dwell in the forest. And it seems that he did really well. He really made progress in his spiritual life. It seems that he attained something and even had disciples and brothers with him. But it was a struggle, and he got very ill, and he knew, in fact, that he was dying. But he still wanted to see the Buddha. He longed to see the Buddha. So he went to where the Buddha was staying. His friends in the Sangha brought him, had to carry him, I think, and a message was sent to the Buddha to come. And the Buddha came to him, and the Buddha says in the sutta, "Why, Vakali, do you want to see this unbeautiful body? He who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. He who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma." It's an incredible moment. And shortly after that, just before he dies, Vakali attains arhatship. And the way it's explained in the Pali text, I find really ugly. It's all sort of explained as, yes, the Buddha's body is loathsome, and Vakali is waking up to that, and he's worked on his Four Noble Truths and all that stuff. I don't believe it. I'm not having it. I think that's scandalous. I think that what the Buddha is saying, he knows that of Vakali's love and devotion to him, but he's saying, look deeper. I wonder if there's even a suggestion of, you know, what Subhuti was talking about, the vast consciousness of the Buddha. That's really what the Dhamma the Buddha is talking about. He's not talking about a doctrine. He's talking about the vast consciousness, what perhaps later tradition calls the Dharmakaya. That's what he's saying for Vakali to look at. Look through him. Look through the Buddha to that vast Dhamma. Because afterwards he says, he who sees the Dhamma sees me. He has it both ways round. He who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. He who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. He has it both ways. So perhaps, if we're to find beauty, union with beauty even, we need to embrace our poverty. We need to embrace our longing. We need to sing from our longing, sing out of our longing, much, much more, even as we play, even as we laugh, even as we celebrate, even as we are courteous and loving to our friends. I'm going to end with a favourite verse from my beloved Ahmad Ghazali, from his treatise on Ishq, on passionate love. He says, probably he sings, "Love is an affliction, and I am not about to abstain from affliction. In fact, when love falls asleep, I turn to it and raise it. My friends tell me, abstain from affliction. Affliction is the heart. How can I abstain from the heart? The tree of love grows amidst my heart. Since it needs water, I shed tears from my eyes. Although love is sweet and sorrow bitter, it is sweeter for me to mix both love and sorrow together."